Last week we started the book of Joshua, and I didn't quite finish the introduction to it. This morning we'll kind of talk in two parts. First, we'll wrap up the overview and introduction to the book of Joshua, and then we'll dive into the second lesson that I wanted to teach from Joshua, which is about Joshua chapter 2 and the Rahab story. And that's not a terribly long story, so I think we'll be able to do both here. When I introduced Joshua, and I told you that I'm using Ralph Davis's commentary on this as a primary guide, a lot of the quotes are from that, and certainly the outline is. And he opens up the book with the introduction to Joshua, pointing out that Joshua bookends with funerals and how valuable that is for us understanding what Joshua is for. We might think of it at a high level as just this book of conquest and victory. This is where the people of God inherit the land and inherit the promises. And that's true. And it's the book where the people of God begin by waiting for the fulfillment of that promise and seeing the death of Moses. And how that casts not a shadow, but a question mark over everything that's going to come after it. How do the people of God walk forward in courage and in faithfulness when the promises of God seem to be delayed and delayed and delayed and delayed, and the most tangible representation they have of those promises is dead? And now they look in front of them, and here's a raging river, and they look behind them, and Moses is dead. What now? And Joshua is going to answer those questions. But Joshua doesn't just begin with a funeral, word of the death of Moses. Let's go to the end of Joshua as well. If y'all will turn to chapter 24. Joshua is so well written that we'll get to see, even in texts like this, where you might not think there's a ton going on, there is quite a bit. And so last week, as an example, when we talked about chapter 1, we talked about how it is grounded in Genesis 12, the promises to Abraham, and it's grounded in Numbers 32 and the potential rebellion of two and a half of the tribes. And now we come to the end of the book of Joshua, and we're in Joshua 24. John, can you read 29 through 33? Those five verses.
Yes. After these things, Joshua the son of Nun, the servant of the Lord, died, being 110 years old. And they buried him in his own inheritance at Timnath-Serah, which is in the hill country of Ephraim, north of the mountain of Gash. Israel served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders who outlived Joshua, and had known all the work that the Lord did for Israel. As for the bones of Joseph, which the people of Israel brought up from Egypt, they buried them at Shechem, in the piece of land that Jacob bought from the sons of Hamor, the father of Shechem, for 100 pieces of money. It became an inheritance of the descendants of Joseph. And Eleazar, the son of Aaron, died, and they buried him at Gibeah, the town of Phinehas, his son, which had been given him in the hill country of Ephraim.
So, how can it be? Maybe we could have understood that the book of Joshua is going to start out with a funeral and a dead Moses, and it creates this tension and this anticipation for how is God going to answer the promises now. But the book of Joshua should end with a happy ending. And then we get to the end of Joshua, and we've got three more funerals. We've got three more dead people in this list. Why? Why does Joshua begin and end with these obituaries? Davis suggests three reasons that I think are spot on. The first is the veracity of God's promise. Look at just Joshua, the bones of Joseph, Eleazar. Look at verses 30, 32, 33. Where are they buried? They're each given a different place, but do you know what those places have in common? They're all in the promised land. They're all buried in the land that God had promised them. The book of Genesis, do you remember how that ends? What's Joseph obsessed with at the end of the book of Genesis?
His bones.
It's kind of a weird ending to the book of Genesis. We're like, man, we got a lot going on. We got a lot to deal with. And you want us to do what? You want us to get your bones and haul them across the desert? Okay. And what happens here? His bones make it to the promised land. Joshua clings to God's Joseph clings to God's promise. Even as he dies, having not inherited the promise, his eyes are pointed toward that fulfillment, toward that land. He's so confident and so grounded in the anticipation of God keeping his promise that he tells his relatives to pick up his bones and take them there when the time comes. He didn't see with the eyes of the flesh, the fulfillment of that promise. He didn't need to live with confidence and assurance that the promise would be fulfilled. Why? He knew the promise maker. He knew that God's promises will be fulfilled. They cannot fail to be fulfilled. Or God has failed to be God. And then the whole thing unravels, including us, by the way. So you won't have to worry about it if it happens. Think about that as a touch point of application for us. Didn't see the fulfillment of the promise, didn't need to. Was able to live confidently, was able to die confidently, talking about Joseph now, because God had made the promise. How much time since the promise was made to Abraham and the bones of Joshua are taken to the land? It's 500 or 600 years. 500 or 600 years. You feel like you've waited a long time? I do. I mean, you do. You feel like you've waited a long time. The book of Revelation talks about, come, Lord Jesus. Come, Lord Jesus. We're supposed to have that yearning that this is not right. Even at its best, this is not right. Every single joy we have is tainted by some tinge of sin and curse and fall. Everything is marred by something. Come, Lord Jesus. And the people of God, living with this promise, did not live in fear because of the promise. Simply because of the promise. Second thing he points out from this text is that there's a hint here of another test for God's people. Jake, will you read verse 31? Reread that.
Israel served the Lord all the days of Joshua, and all the days of the elders who outlived Joshua, and had known all the work that the Lord did for Israel.
So do you hear in that text, there's a record of faithfulness. There's also a hint of wavering. The Bible, and especially the book of Joshua, constantly links Eleazar and Joshua, just the same way that in the Pentateuch, you have this constant link of Aaron and Moses. And so the deaths of both Eleazar and Joshua signify the complete passing of that generation. The conquest generation is gone with the death of those two. And so the question remains, what happens to Israel now? With that generation gone, will they still serve God? Without Joshua and Eleazar and the elders of that generation, when they're gone, will they still serve God? Now, why is that such a familiar and critical question? It's that's right, because it's the challenge of second generation religion. It's the challenge of second generation religion. There is a continual danger in second generation religion because the second generation has leaned on, has followed, has seen the example of, has had the good pressure and influence from that first generation. And so a bunch of things get wrapped up together. Obedience and love for and respect for and reverence for not just God, the object of faith, but the generation of people that showed you that faith, that perhaps led you to faith, that taught you the faith, that demonstrated the faith. And all of that just gets wrapped up together. And when that first generation is gone, what does the second generation do? And you see this over and over and over and over again. If you read the books of Kings and Chronicles, you find that it's not really hard for a wicked generation to follow in the footsteps of their wicked generation parents. Wickedness seems to be passed down pretty easily and pretty easy to follow. Faithfulness is hard. Will you remain faithful? Will you keep the promise? Think about what that first generation had seen. That first generation saw the cutting off of the Jordan. That generation saw the collapse of Jericho. That's what they'd seen. But they didn't do those things. God did those things. And so will the second generation be able to remember and to receive by faith the truth that God did these things, though they have not seen with their own eyes? Will they anchor on the one who was faithful to their parents, the one who was faithful to the previous generation? You see why this might be somewhat relevant to our lives? We are the second generation, and we can apply those things to our families as well as we think about our children, obviously. But we are the second generation. We're actually the 52nd or the 82nd generation. I don't know. I'm not good at math. But we're a long way away from the apostles. And that's why so much of the New Testament is receive the faith. Not your faith, not a faith. Now, receive the faith. Why? Because the faith is a set of facts. It's a set of propositions, of statements about reality that are true, that have been attested to by the eyewitnesses, and we don't see them. And we're in that sense the second generation. Will we believe the apostles' testimony? There's at Lead with Character on Thursday and Friday nights. We have some social time at the end of the night where guys will sit around who haven't already passed out asleep in their beds. It's a very long day. And we'll sit around a circle and have cigars and conversations. And I'm always kind of milling about and listening to the different conversations and trying to connect people and make sure everybody's included. And I heard a great conversation between a guy that I know somewhat from Greenville and then a guy who was on the trip from France. He'd actually flown over from France with his son, and his dad lives here in North Carolina, and they went on the trip together. Yes. Aren't they all? And they were talking about the reliability of the Gospels, and the guy from Greenville was making the case that the fact that God used to convert him. He was converted as an adult. And God did the converting and all those things. And he said, but the thing, the fact that God used to convert me, the thing that clicked in my brain that I had no other answer to, was the martyrdom of the apostles. Because they were willing, lots of people in history, he was saying, have been willing to be martyrs for things they haven't seen. I'm going to go be a martyr for a cause, and I haven't seen it. I don't know. I'm taking it on somebody's word. I'm going to go. And he said what got him about the apostles was they were martyrs for something they saw. They saw it with their own eyes, exactly what happened. And so if they're carrying this story through, to what end? For what purpose? And he said, I couldn't wrap my mind around the possibility that the apostles were lying. It doesn't make any sense. Will we believe the apostles' testimony? Will we believe the scriptures? As second generation, there is a test for God's people always. Is it enough that God said it? And the test is, will we believe that which we have not seen? Is it enough that God said it? Third, the need for God's victory. We've already talked about this a little bit. Graves are a powerful witness to the faithfulness of God, aren't they? The bones get carried into the promised land. God answers his promises to his people. They're a powerful witness to the goodness and the faithfulness of God. But they're graves. They're graves. They're death. That's not how this should be. Genesis ends with Joseph's death. Deuteronomy ends with Moses' death. Joshua ends with Joshua's death. You see the faithfulness of God throughout it all. It's all over the text. But you also see the sting of sin. You see death. And so it's a sign of the wrath of God, the curse of God, the holiness of God that must punish sin and rebellion. And it makes us call out, we need one who can abolish death. Getting the land is great. The fulfillment of that promise, the land of milk and honey, woohoo, this is great, except you're still going to die. Every generation that's born in that promised land still dies. That's why between the promises and the Psalms, and then you get to the New Testament, and there's all these prayers for rest, and they're praying for the rest of the promised land, right? But then the Bible tells us, no, actually they're not. They prayed for rest even when they were in the promised land. Why? Because there's still death. There's still death. They need freedom. They need God's rest. They need eternal rest with God where this stuff is put away. And so we need, as Paul writes in 2 Timothy, I think I might actually be the New Testament reading this morning. Pretty sure it is. We need the one who has abolished death. That's the opening of Joshua. So the whole of Joshua is going to be bookended by these reminders that it is God who brings about the fulfillment of his promises. He's not beholden to any particular man or people. That it is God who made his promises. So the promises are absolute. It doesn't matter what circumstances we see that make the promises seem unlikely or impossible. The promises are from God and he does not break his promises. And we're supposed to see in this, we need a bigger promise than just land. We need a heavenly kingdom. We need more than just rest from the warring nations and national security. We need eternal rest with God. We need the death of death. You ever read that? There's a great book, The Death of Death and the Death of Christ. The book is challenging. The introduction to it is worth its weight in gold. If you read about 5 or 6 pages of the introduction to the death of death and the death of Christ. I don't know if we have it on the book table or not. That's what we need. We need the death of death. Don't you? I mean, I don't have to ask you. You feel that. Everyone in this church feels that. Some of us have felt it more deeply than others. We all feel it. You need the death of death.